Welcome to the Social Science of War. This podcast is brought to you by the Department of Social Sciences at West Point. We bring together scholars and practitioners to better understand warfare, the Army, and national security strategy. The views expressed in this episode do not represent the views of West Point or any agency of the U.S. government. We hope you enjoy the show.
Welcome to the Social Science of War podcast. I'm Nikisa Jahanbani, one of the co-hosts. With the unfolding conflict in the Middle East, we have seen firsthand the implications of Iranian proxies' access to drones, both in their targeting of U.S. forces as well as U.S. allies in the region. Recent DIA reports have also shed light on Iranian origins of the Houthis' drones, as well as those deployed by Russia in the Ukraine war. Joining us today to delve into this really timely topic are experts from academia, policy, and practice. First, we have Lieutenant General Ken Tovo, a retired Green Beret who concluded his distinguished Army career as the commanding general of the U.S. Army Special Operations Command at Fort Liberty. In his career, he has had various assignments within Special Operations and NATO, including several deployments to Bosnia, Afghanistan, Iraq, and Sierra Leone. Currently, he leads DOL Enterprises as president and CEO, a firm focused on strategic planning, risk management, and organizational effectiveness consulting. He is the chairman of the Green Beret Foundation. Today, we're also joined by Dr. Carrie Chavez, who serves as a political science instructor at Texas Tech University, specializing in international conflict, security politics, and strategies, with a focus on emerging technologies, incredibly timely for today's discussion. She's also a non-resident research fellow with the Institute for Global Affairs and a two-time non-resident research fellow with the Modern War Institute. Her data set on violent non-state actor drone adoption has received international acclaim and is considered a cornerstone in understanding quantitative trends on the phenomenon. Finally, we are joined by Mr. Behnam Ben Taliblu, a senior fellow at FDD, the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, where he focuses on Iranian security and political issues. Leveraging his native Farsi skills and subject matter expertise, he tracks a wide array of Iran-related topics. A recognized voice in his field, Behnam is routinely asked to brief government, military, and diplomatic audiences, and he's testified about Iran before the U.S. Congress, Canadian Parliament, and U.K. House of Commons. He's the author of Arsenal, Assessing the Islamic Republic of Iran's Ballistic Missile Program. Dr. Chavez, I was wondering if you could start us out. How do non-state actors historically and presently adopt weapons technologies?
I think this stems from a couple of things. Of course, these groups have a desire. That's the first place we would start. But then beyond that, I mean, most of them would desire to attain exquisite weapons technologies to advance their agendas. But it also depends on the opportunities they have and the capacity that they have. So opportunities, generally, they don't have access to weapons of this scale because of regulations, and they can get acquisition from civilians. That's a very finite trickling supply for mostly small arms and light weapons. So it's not of this type of advanced ilk that we're talking about in this particular podcast. Another way that they can attain them is, and this is probably the largest way, is looting insecure state stockpiles. Especially after states collapse, you have a pretty broad variety of weapon systems that are insecured. And that leads to a kind of punctuated equilibrium in the black market, because normally there are small apertures of weapons that are siphoned into that world. But when states collapse, or when there is some kind of chaotic or mass violent situation, that aperture broadens significantly, and there's a large stockpile that can funnel down into the violent non-state actor world. And it looks different, like in Afghanistan, it siphoned down to just a single or a small handful of groups because of the political control of that region that they had. In Libya, it kind of devolved down to atomized groups because of the fragmentation or the fractionalization of those societies. But there's still, even with those opportunities, there's still capacity limitations. So in both of those cases, what we saw was primarily a looting of small arms and light weapons, and then an illicit trafficking into the kind of ejected into the surrounding regions. So talking about transfers from external sponsors as another opportunity that these groups have, it's kind of an in-between in the quantity and the type and the tempo of weapons that they can get. But what it does is it provides a different avenue for them to bolster capacity. There are financial, technical, infrastructural limitations on a group's ability to, of course, to indigenously produce. Like, that's the kind of the ultra expression of it. But also to maintain and to deploy advanced weapon systems requires bandwidth in each of those categories. And it takes having some kind of sponsor to provide that tacit knowledge before states can, or for non-state groups can really take it up with prowess. So talking about the Iran's threat network and the proxies that operate in the Middle East, and of course we can talk to some about Ukraine as well, because I think this dovetails well. The advanced weaponry that they have access to from Iran, it still abides by a kind of scarce air power logic or scarce weapons logic. It still is expensive and intensive to manufacture. So I think these groups tend to field those exquisite weapon systems with more caution and more strategic, more of a mindset of that strategic scarcity. And something I want to introduce into this conversation that I think problematizes this whole arena is the democratization of, in particular, air power with commercial drones. Because even though they have access to those arsenals, and I'm bringing this up, Nikisa, because of your research, your recent publications looking at drones and the connection with Ukraine, and that's also some of the stuff that I research is the commercialization of drones. Even like Hezbollah, who was one of their entrepreneurs as early as we think 2004 or 5, was flying advanced Iranian drones into Israeli airspace. There was, I think it was 2013 or 2014, there was a report that came out that they did have quite an extensive arsenal, but at the same time, they had an even larger arsenal of commercial drones. And they recognized Hezbollah is kind of the prototype of this proxy and of that enterprising spirit. They recognized the value of that scalability. Of course, this became really salient in the Russia-Ukraine war because these are two strong states that have all of that capacity and opportunity. And yet both of them also pivoted to this tactical air power through commercialized technologies. Again, in the October 7 Hamas invasion into Israel, largely what they did in that initial salvo is they used commercial drones in tandem with some other technologies that they had to kind of simulate mass. Because those technologies are so cheap and so broadly available, they have, I think before, a lot of actors didn't see the action potential in them, didn't see the relative value in them compared to like a Reaper. But there's an idea in technology adoption called affordance, and it is how actors perceive that something could be used. So with the demonstration points that we've had in warfare, including with Islamic State, which was just a maven with commercial technologies and especially with drones, I think we're seeing this practice or this notion diffuse across these groups. And so what we have now is pretty considerable drone diversity and in general kind of arsenal diversity. It's just become more granular. It's become more scalable across the gray zone, but also across the full spectrum of conflict. And that enables that gray zone warfare to be more nuanced. It enables these subversive foreign policy maneuvers to have more finesse, which I think is to their advantage. And it's harder to interdict or to degrade these drone programs that really run the gamut because those technologies are not regulated the same way that the more exquisite ones are. And the last thing I want to say about this, to kind of come back around to the confluence of desire and capacity and opportunity, is because these proxy groups do have this full scale of technology available to them, it's concerning. It's particularly concerning to me because these groups tend to be more norm-defying even than, like, you know, the bad cats, like the rogue states like Iran, from the perception of the West. So when you combine that with that richer scale of capacity, that generates more problems for security in theater and in domestic populations.
I think Dr. Chavez covered it really well. The only thing I would say, the other nuance that might be worth listening or thinking about is the ability of the proxy group to use indigenous intellectual capacity. to refine and develop. We've seen this in Iraq, where some of the insurgent groups were using intellectual capital out of the university program, if you will, to recruit in at the universities, particularly engineers, to take what they already had as triggering devices and make them more robust. How to evolve as we evolved our countermeasures. They were using folks out of the institutions to try and help come up with new methods for detonation, for example. We watched ISIS trying to use Mosul University as a weapons development platform, particularly in the area of chemical warfare. You know, we talked about the ubiquitous nature now of commercial drones. And so you've got folks taking that off-the-shelf commercial drone and then using in-house intellectual capacity to figure out all the different uses, how to do different drop mechanisms, how do I strap this shell on, and all those kind of things. So, you know, kind of from a targeting perspective, I think we shouldn't lose the fact that it's not just all about outside weapons transfers in or folks buying commercial drones off the commercial market. There's also that other aspect of where are they getting the folks, the engineers, the scientists' capabilities that they've been provided.
Maybe just a footnote to that footnote. And with specific reference to Iran. The first is all of these systems are weapons of the weak. And they're weapons of the weak based on how the actor, in this case for our conversation, Iran, is able to innovate. And it's a story of innovation over time, or change over time. So that logic of scarcity changes based on the changing capabilities of the state, but also the affordability of these inputs for these technologies. So when you look at the way Russia is using Iranian drones, there is a logic of scarcity to it, not because of the mass use of drones, but because of the scarcity of the missile production, where everyone knows the one-way attack drone is the poor man's land attack cruise missile. So there is this logic at play, and it's absolutely the same logic of national resource scarcity and national economic insecurity that led Iran to, when you were talking about air power for a second, to go for ballistic missiles rather than jets or fighter aircraft, multi-role aircraft that are not use it or lose it one time, that were expensive to maintain, that required more human hours to improve, versus missiles which required less people on site, less people on staff, had a high J curve to learn, but once you learned, could easily replicate. And then the really scary part is everyone is talking about commercialization, and scary in terms of non-kinetic pushback is that there is a dwindling amount of non-kinetic pushback for this. If you look at all of these capabilities on a little sideways slope here, at the top you have nuclear, where you have international legal regimes guarding or prohibiting the transfer or safeguarding things like fissile material. You have the NPT, the Nuclear Suppliers Group. Below that, you have the delivery vehicle stuff, which is international, but not necessarily legal, but international and political, because these are voluntary regimes, like the MTCR, like the Hague Code of Conduct, like the Proliferation Security Initiative. With the mass commercialization of these drones barely even fit in to things like the MTCR. Or you would have to have a more creative legal definition for some of the inputs of this drone technology in one of those legal regimes to be able to enforce it. And you need that to be a shared norm. So, okay, some of these drones do not meet the MTCR thresholds, but can still be treated as a, cruise missile, or treated as something else under the UN Conventional Register of Arms. So with Iran, for a long time, it was procurement. Then at home, it was reverse engineering production. What we're all afraid of now, we're talking about proliferation of these capabilities. But the regime is slowly touting about sales. So this is, evolution of free proliferation to sales. The regime last year talked about making over $1 billion of arms sales. The Islamic Republic is increasingly showing up at defense expos around the world, in Iraq at IQDEX, in Qatar at DIMDEX, in Russia at Army 2023, in Serbia just recently. So they're slowly emerging as not just third world proliferator, but third world arms salesman, precisely because of this commercial affordability and the lack of coherent legal regimes to stop them.
If I could kind of two-finger both of those. They both gave me ideas. Jonah, you're talking about this indigenous intellectual capacity to refine even advanced systems, but also the combination, the surprise combination of things. One is, I think it's very cunning for Iran to rely on that kind of innovation, because terrorist organizations have an urgency, a pressure to innovate. I can't remember this a few years ago, but there was a statistic that the majority, I think almost 90% of terrorist organizations don't survive their first year because of the extreme asymmetry and the difficulty of getting manpower and materiel and intelligence to advance their agendas. So because of that pressure, they tend to innovate faster and more imaginatively than military bureaucracies. And I think combined with that, because we have these dual tracks of, you know, military-grade weapons development and proliferation, but then also these commercial avenues, we're in a different kind of era of innovation, because those commercial technologies reward and promote tinkering, experimenting, again, those surprise combinations. But then when you have that kind of era amid globalization, where some kind of successful surprise combination can then be diffused, it happens much more quickly than it has in past, you know, eras or generations. So I think that that's a really important thing to point out, is how that localized intellectual capacity can actually seed a network and scale up to the, you know, the advanced state level and then be transferred elsewhere. And then, Benham, you're talking about these weapons of the week, and especially talking about the scale from commercial to advanced drones, that causes attrition of the stronger enemy. I mean, we saw at the very beginning of the commercial drone era, we saw states, and it's still to some degree some of them do, we saw them sending up Patriot missiles to knock down an Amazon drone. We still see situations like that because we don't have the defense architectures that can, well, first, they're not ubiquitous. Second, they can't always integrate to recognize all the different, you know, the diversity of drones that are coming out. And the counter UAS systems that we have, there's no silver bullet, so you have to have a suite of technologies. And so consequently, we do tend to see a lot more attrition because of counter UAS efforts than it takes for them to attack. And that's problematic. That's not sustainable long term. And if we're going to develop good defenses to that, it requires that we stay agile and adaptive as they continue to change these technologies, because they will, but also that it be cost sustainable.
Mr. Talablu, I was wondering if you had insight into Iran's drone proliferation, if it mirrors its proliferation of other weapons technology to proxies.
So at least in the drone case, you see congruity with the other trends, you could say, of proliferation or support for local production of what we like to call the entire unmanned aerial threat spectrum that Iran has mastered, and mastered again because of investments early on, regime decisions early on, brought to you by, you know, a conflict that really was there, you know, World War I, World War II, Vietnam, and Iraq War, which was the 1980-1988 Iran-Iraq War. And this kind of present at creation moment is the incubator for all of the threats we face from the Islamic Republic today. Terror proxies, they were created during that conflict. Maritime insecurity, threats to freedom of navigation, oil, you know, oil insecurity threats, threats to the other states' ability to export oil, happened during the Iran-Iraq War. Ballistic missile use, the War of the Cities, Iran-Iraq War. For Iran's first reported drone use during the Iran-Iraq War. Very crude systems that were essentially dropping grenades. So this really is a wellspring from which the regime draws upon. And the movement and the heavy regime investment in these cheaper weapon systems that require, as you were just saying, a heavier or more expensive conventional offsets is something that you can empirically trace from this period of time. But now, once it's reached this fruition, you know, the ye shall know them from the fruits kind of moment, they were saying this stuff out loud. In 2021, Fars News Agency, an Iranian media organization linked strongly to the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, was talking about the 11-day exchange between, I think, Hamas and Israel, and exactly this incongruity between costs. And what we all implied and inferred as analysts before we saw in real time the regime saying, which is that the headline, I'll never forget the headline is, whether you intercept or not, you lose. And there, it's the financial component of warfare of a financially weaker adversary, bringing this to the force or turning an insecurity into a source of security. So why do I say that now when we talk about drone proliferation and mirroring trends of other arms proliferation? It's that this is a hyper-localized effort, and the regime proliferates capabilities it feels comfortable with, either doing something new, which is testing a capability in theater, that's specifically an Iran-Yemen connection. But beyond that, you look at the region, a different type of capability, a different type of unmanned aerial threat, mortar, rocket, drone, cruise missile, ballistic missile, this entire spectrum, based on the needs of the adversary against a local based on the needs of the local actor against a local adversary that they both share. So Hezbollah, we were just talking about, is the most successful export of the Islamic Revolution. We call it literally the Hezbollah model. It's, you know, the patron proxy relationship par excellence. There's IRGC memoirs that talk about Hezbollah in Syria being part of Iranian command and control in Syria after 2013. This is in the Hossein Hamadani memoirs, his time there. This contrasts sharply to the Houthis, which, you know, Iran did not create like Hezbollah, but they co-opted with this material support. So the Delta Wing drones, some of the Shahed drones, the 131, the 136, you see the Houthis using earlier in 2019 before they go from proxy to patron. So sometimes we have to look at these reverse trend lines. The regime develops something explicitly for in-theater use for a proxy. Then once it's proven, goes back to the patron. You also have the first instance of Iranian ballistic missile reverse proliferation, where the regime creates a variant of an existing Iranian ballistic missile, does not unveil it publicly for the Iranian audience. It appears in Yemen. The Houthis, for the first time ever, and in the history of any Iranian proxy ever, or in any member of the Axis of Resistance ever, in August 2019, fired a medium-range ballistic missile, definitely surpassing MTCR thresholds, literally a nuclear-capable system. And then it disappears, and from August 2019, it comes back in January, February 2022, as the munition that the Houthis use, again, at MRBM ranges, to strike airports and U.S. bases, thankfully all intercepted due to THAAD, in the UAE. And so you see a different risk tolerance for proliferating a kind of weapon to a different actor based on the needs of that adversary, based on the needs of that actor against a shared adversary. So once we've been dealing now with the maritime threat that the Houthis are posing, which also feature drones, but also feature anti-ship ballistic missiles, another thing that no other member of the Axis of Resistance has. Lebanese Hezbollah has anti-ship cruise missiles. They used that in 2006. All Iranian variants of Chinese anti-ship cruise missiles. But these capabilities now factor in, and their efficacy changes the strategy of the proxies. So the inability of the proxies to fire medium-range ballistic missiles. So Yemen, from October 19 to November 1st, fails at firing land attack cruise missiles, medium-range ballistic missiles, and these one-way drones at Israel. They're all intercepted, and then they settle for low-hanging fruit, which is November 1 to present. Okay, if you can't strike southern Israel due to the successes of this costly architecture of air defense, F-16s, F-35s, Arrow 2, PAC-3, whatever they've been doing, then they transfer to the undefended target. So very much local actor competency, local actor capability, and that goes again to what was mentioned at the front end of the podcast. The Houthis are very different than the rest of these proxy and partner networks because they inherited, so talk about state collapse and arsenal capture, they inherited not just the missile and rocket force of Ali Abdel Saleh, who was the former ousted president of Yemen amid the Arab Spring. They got the rocket engineers. There are still things that the Houthis are firing that the Yemenis procured in the 90s that was missed in the air campaign that predated Operation Decisive Storm in 2015. So it's not just everything is Iranian produced, but it's stuff that they've been able to hoard and, you know, amend on the battlefield, air-to-air missiles becoming surface-to-air missiles. And the drone proliferation mirrors this almost one-to-one.
So I'm imagining, or I'm conceptualizing the way you're describing this, the localized development or refinement of something, and then it reverse transfers back up to Iran and then potentially proliferates elsewhere. But there certainly is this kind of relative or contextual value or competency in those localized theaters. I wonder, though, about the remainder of the network's interfacing. Not that there's a one-to-one node here, because I did an empirical study on the diffusion or on the proliferation of drones across violent non-state actors. And even including a control for those groups that are Iran-sponsored, which that is a sizable and statistically significant factor for groups that adopt UAS, but even controlling for that, by far the strongest determinant of that is being networked with a fellow drone user, a lateral network. And I don't know whether it's, I'm doing a social network analysis right now, I'm not sure whether it's stronger in allies, like joint operations or transfer of tacit knowledge, or whether it's emulation of enemies when it's used to effect on the battlefield. Of course, Islamic State was, you know, commercial drone entrepreneur, so that probably factors into that. But in the social network analysis that I'm doing, it demonstrates that you don't even have to be directly networked to a drone user anymore because it has diffused so much. There's a measure called eigencentrality. You just have to be connected to another actor who is connected to a drone user for this really to make it onto the radar of a group. So I really wonder, given what you're talking about with these local capacities, how do those, not just in a controlled way, go back up to Iran and then strategically get seated elsewhere? How are they moving through this network at large?
I think, and again, this is the uniqueness of the Iran-Yemen connection, notwithstanding, because that is the only theater where you've had, and it's, again, it's not the proxy develops it and it goes to the patron. It's the patron develops it as an arsenal in exile for the proxy. They test it, and then it goes back to the patron and is unveiled. So, you know, the Iranians develop a variant of the Qiyam-2 short-range ballistic missile. They give it to the Houthis. The Houthis first call it the Burkhan-3, then they call it the Zulfagar. They use it in 2019, in 2022. Then in September 2022, Iran parades that missile mm-hmm. as the Rezvan. So it comes full circle. So that's one. Two, I think, for the, you know, another kind of control here could be local actor competency sans this patron.
Right.
And, you know, one factor impacting the competency is their ability to get into, you know, we still call them illicit networks here in D.C., despite the lack of the regimes treating them all the same way. The local actor tie into an illicit network. And in my experience, having the patron be the intermediary to the illicit network goes a great way for you. So I have not seen any evidence, you know, the Iraqis, the, you know, Lebanese Hezbollah, the Houthis in Yemen, directly doing the illicit material procurement. That seems to be all coming from the state. They can do any kind of local engineering. And in 2014, you had the deputy of the IRGC Aerospace Force talking about teaching a man to fish rather than giving him a fish. But the one who's given them the hook is still, the material is still the foreign patron. So I think that tie into the foreign patron, whether it's for illicit finance or illicit material, is going to be this outsized driver of military capability.
I would ask you, how much weight would you assign to the material transfer versus the organizational, like the human resource capacity, the tacit knowledge that has to be transferred, because that can be shared. We have evidence that Hezbollah has done a lot of that. And I also wonder how different Hezbollah is in this framework that you are sketching, because they are kind of a distinct actor, kind of a node in this network. So how much can they, I'm going to pun intended, proxy for Iran in this network? Can you speak to those two issues?
I think with Hezbollah, you really touched the connective tissue here, because Hezbollah has trained Iraqi Shia militias in Iran. Mm-hmm. Hezbollah has trained Iraqi Shia militias in Iraq. Hezbollah has fought in Syria,
right.
And Hezbollah has reportedly been active in Yemen. So it very much is this connective tissue between IRGC Quds Force, IRGC Aerospace Force, Lebanese Hezbollah, local Arab proxy, or local Arab partner. And one wonders, and there isn't good work on this, because in a lot of these theaters, it's reportedly for Yemen, or you have to rely on, you know, more dubious accounts. But in places where it's like empirically proven, like Iran, Iraq, Syria, you can get a little bit more data. What is the nature of the training? Is it that, you know, first and foremost, these guys speak Arabic? Is it that, second, Iran trusts Lebanese Hezbollah as the proxy par excellence? So if you have material flowing, you need it midwifed by a trusted partner. We don't know exactly what is it that is being trained. And that is a huge, you know, as much open source, as much as closed source, intel question, but the elasticity of Hezbollah, the more they're in these theaters, the less Lebanese Hezbollah is increasingly looking and increasingly becoming, and more a part of what those, you know, IRGC memoirs said of almost part of command and control, or almost, you know, we think hub and spoke for patron proxy, but it might be hub, spoke mm-hmm. in some of these areas.
I will say that you covered, I heard the piece about Lebanese Hezbollah in Iraq, well documented. We captured folks from Lebanese Hezbollah during the Iraq-Iran war, or during our experience in Iraq. I can tell you during my time at SOCCENT, which was 11 to 13, there were documented cases of Lebanese Hezbollah in Yemen, northern Yemen, working with the Houthis, training them on a variety of things to include some of the same IED initiation technology that we had seen over in Iraq. So it's clear that when you talk about kind of Kerry's question about knowledge transfer, LH is part of kind of that informal network of moving TTPs to some of the lateral proxy groups that Iran controls.
I want to pivot the conversation just a little and come back to you, General Tovo. So some of the topics we're talking today are issues that the U.S. forces have dealt with in the region for decades. And so while we're seeing a sort of more recent implication with Iran drone proliferation to various groups in the region, and the implications that has directly for U.S. forces in the context of Iranian-backed attacks on U.S. installations in Iraq and Syria, as well as interests in the Red Sea, I was wondering if you could speak to us a little bit more about your experiences while you were deployed of what this threat looked like on the ground.
Yeah, sure. I spent quite a bit of time in Iraq in the early thousands, and then was also tracking this threat, as I mentioned, as a SOCCENT commander in 11 through 13, and then obviously still kept an eye on it in later jobs. The challenge, of course, is that when you're in Iraq, Iran's got easy proximity. I mean, proximity matters in this when you talk about a state sponsoring surrogate groups and proxies. The further you get geographically away from the source, the harder it gets. But clearly, Iran has demonstrated that even geographic separation is not impossible for them to overcome. You look at what they've done with Yemen. They've taken traditional smuggling networks in the Middle East, using dhows and other mechanisms to move weapons from and equipment from Iran into Yemen, all the way through the Red Sea into the Gaza, et cetera. So on the ground, though, I'll tell you that I think it's also fairly well documented, open source, that one of the most significant casualty producers during our time in Iraq was, in fact, Iranian explosively formed penetrator technology, which, were the most casualty producing of the IEDs. It was, kind of a technological leap, if you will, from what the standard roadside bomb was, as well as the initiation devices, right? As we developed new countermeasures, it was Iranian development and technology of passive infrared initiation devices coupled with IEDs that really drove casualty rates up. We had direct evidence that this was coming right across the border from Iran, into the Shia proxy forces at the time, Kataib Hezbollah, and the other special groups. So this is a direct threat that we've been dealing with. Really, the Iranian threat has been targeted against us really going from the start in 79. But as we became more involved in the Middle East, they've continued to attack U.S. forces in every asymmetric way they can, with just enough plausible deniability to provide them a veil of defense against a U.S. counter.
So, Mr. Talabluf, if I could ask you, do you think Iran has the ambition for such scope? Because, he just mentioned if they have the desire, they certainly could. And we've seen these material transfers to Ukraine. Do you think that they are looking for regional supremacy, or is it expanding beyond that?
I certainly think it's expanding beyond that. And one thing I've always been frustrated by with the conversation in D.C., where I live and work, is that You know, you either look at Iran as it's very much a Polaroid or a Kodak or a screenshot or a snapshot approach, and it's never a story of change over time. And that Polaroid or that snapshot is always like the threat is a 2 out of 10 or it's a 12 out of 10. It's never where it really is, which is a 4, 5, 6, but it's a 4, 5, 6 with a delta towards it, which is and it's growing and it's projecting. And we have to connect the dots to this feature. So there's a major talk about, you know, geography and proximity empowering a certain kind of capability. I guarantee you there's a ton of things, and I'm sure there's reporting on it, that are going, Iranian coast of the Caspian Sea to the Russian coast of the Caspian Sea, and it's not just the caviar trade. It's very much going to be the components for the indigenization attempt that the Russians are making for that drone factory in Yelabaluga, or for more smaller scale components for the Geron 1 or Geron 2, which is their Shahed 131 or 136. So there, this logistics infrastructure is really, really key to understanding why Iran could have, with commercially available cheap technology, as you mentioned, this global impact. I don't have one-to-one evidence for this, but when you look at jurisdictions that have downed more recent versions of U.S. reconnaissance or combat drones in the past, I tend to think that the North Korean copies of American drones are not stuff that they got from South Korea, but are things that Iran may have shot down in the region, or their proxies may have shot down in the region and flew in this back and went in this backward kind of form of proliferation from Iran to North Korea rather than North Korea to Iran, which was a previous trend line. And the regime in Iran, at least they love touting these things. They used to get, you know, missile support and military support from Libya and Syria. Now they tout that they're the ones building missile factories there, at least for Syria. So the changing technology, the pre-existing logistics infrastructure, and their mastery of these other kind of illicit trades predisposes them to have an extra regional reach. But even in the region, in the heartland, they are abetted by, you know, this geographic proximity argument.
And I would just add that both Hezbollah and Iran, through the IRGC Quds Force, have global networks. I mean, I think it's well documented. I spent a couple of years at the Southern Command headquarters, and we were tracking very closely the development of Lebanese Hezbollah clandestine networks across our hemisphere for a variety of means. I mean, I think Nikisa just published an article recently about Iranian drones that talks about, you know, the Iranians building drone factories in Venezuela. And so, you know, the idea that Iran is a regional only problem, I think, is a little bit narrow.
And the folly of the snapshot approach is that even when the bulk of the threats are regional, we miss the delta that is brought to you by those logistics networks. So, you know, Venezuela, Cavim, I think, is one of their defense. It's like they're, you know, one of their major defense contractors, CAVIM. They do a bunch with Iran's Modafal and other kind of defense industrial base. You know, it's moving beyond Venezuela. You know, Bolivia now has expressed an interest in Iranian drones. I'm sure there's going to be something with Belarus soon, given the relationship between Belarus and Russia and, you know, the reporting early in the Ukraine war that, you know, there were IRGC officials or whatnot helping the Russians train on this stuff in Belarus as well as Russia.
So how would a social scientist or a practitioner, a policymaker, harness this logistics angle? How would we incorporate it into our assessments, into our policies? How would it change that?
I just think this logistics infrastructure, everyone talks, for example, Belt and Road and, you know, ups and downs with that. We don't talk about the rest of that. You know, we talk about Belt and Road, you know, the hub and then the spoke, but are the spokes other little hubs for mm-hmm. other kind of activities? You know, it's still kind of taboo to talk about, unfortunately, or for political reasons in Washington, some of these Iranian airliners, including state airliners that can fly to major Western European capitals. It's still taboo to say, hey, by the way, they've also ferried like men, money, and munitions to like four war zones in the Middle East. Maybe they shouldn't be flying into, you know, major Western European capital X or minor European city Y. So I think one is at least doing a better job of painting the picture of telling a story of logistics. You know, those open source commercial software tracking services can be a force multiplier for, you know, U.S. customs and whatnot that are looking at tankers coming from problematic jurisdictions where you've had, you know, like Hong Kong, for example, high instances of end-user obfuscation or diversion of certain goods. That's precisely how you get American and Western European commercial components into drones. So I think on the social science side, it's incorporating this data into the studies, like, you know, how equipped is Iran for this? How equipped are the proxies for this? And what kind of controlling role does geographic proximity play into this? That can help develop a model as to how far Iran can go. And then for the offset, for the policymaker, particularly the military, and everyone really touched on this, I think is, you know, sometimes copying the adversary is poor form, but I do think we need to copy the adversary here because integrated air and missile defense is expensive. We do need to have cheaper, you know, one-way attack drones. I think if the Iranians faced, instead of a CRAM and a PAC-3 to cover low tier and higher tier for the Shahed 136, if they faced, you know, an American, you know, there is the Switchblade and other things too, but if they faced a much cheaper American one-way attack drone, we could have quantity function as a quality of its own. And I think in the battlefield here, this is where we need a different philosophical approach. These are adversaries that innovate with limited material capabilities because they have a high degree of resolve and they're fighting in an area, in a theater where they have a high degree of interest in maintaining some kind of an outcome. So the regular capabilities we bring to the bear are not going to be sufficient to run the gambit, particularly when there's a time asymmetry and an interest asymmetry and a resolve asymmetry. So we need to decrease the cost of our involvement and fight differently. If Shia militia installations in Iraq and Syria didn't face JDAMs, but face swarms buzzing of cheaper drones consistently, I think that could go a long way in the minds of these actors in changing the sticky reputation for American irresolution and expensive war fighting to making them see us as more agile and more resolute and being able to fight longer because we're fighting cheaper.
Yeah, there's a lot there. I think you hit a lot of great points. Let me just start kind of where you ended. You know, part of, I think we need to give our adversaries credit, right? They have developed some asymmetric approaches that are very much focused on cheap and quantity that really puts our emphasis on expensive, low numbers, highly precise capabilities at risk, right? I mean, when we have to use $1 million Patriot to shoot down a $20,000 drone, that's just not sustainable because we can't match in quantity and cost. So part of this is our adversaries have developed a way of war that's, you know, gives them an asymmetric advantage to what we've developed as the Western way of war over the last 40 or 50 years. You know, this idea of what is, you know, back to Kerry's question, what is the logistics network and infrastructure tell us, and, you know, as far as an approach? And I agree with everything you said. We've done over the years a lot of this mapping of planes, trains, and automobiles, I'll call it. But in the end, at the policy level, we need to actually have a will to act and a recognition. And part of it is because, as you said, we look at Iran in snapshots, in Polaroid takes in time, if you will. And Iran has maintained a very steady, it's got its ups and downs, but they have been on point since 1979 that the U.S. is the adversary and they're going to impose asymmetric costs against us when they can. They take opportunities wherever they can. And we get interested in it at a crisis or a crescendo, and then we'll move on a year from now. We need to engage Iran and its proxies on a much more consistent basis, mapping the network, which we've done, but also acting against that. All that said, we've done the same thing for, what is it now, 40 years that we've had a war on drugs, coming out of South America, going north. Interdiction only carries you so far. At some point, if we're serious about stemming Iranian malign activity, we're going to need to be serious about trying to impose costs. And honestly, even after what we've watched over the last couple months since 7 October, I do not think we have done anything that is really deterring Iranian behavior and causing them to recalculate and assess whether or not the path they're on is going to be more reward or more pain. And until we do something that actually deters and exacts costs and gives the promise of even higher costs in the future, we are not going to deter Iranian behavior. And we can do like we did a couple weeks ago, interdict a Dow of weapons going somewhere and you know, continue to bolster our own and our ability to shoot quadcopters on up out of the sky. But in the end, we're going to have to change the Iranian behavior, and that's a different set of actions.
I wonder if you think some of the solutions are more structural versus kinetic, because to respond, to kind of provide that front, that strong front that is deterring, that's more of a kinetic threat, a retaliatory threat that will impose costs. But then we're talking about these logistics, and we're talking about interdicting and degrading the very capacities. That's more of a structural approach. And I think the U.S. has maybe a dysfunctional proclivity for that kinetic response. I think it's hard to measure the structural ones, and of course they require longer time horizons and deeper investments that it's harder to credit claim, especially in, you know, an endogenous electoral cycle. So I wonder if, first of all, you have any insight on, for a threat like this, what is an appropriate mixture of solutions? And then I also was thinking, as you were talking about the types of technologies that we need to properly respond to this, because it is not sustainable to use our exquisite platforms, but we're also not preparing for that conflict. I mean, our national defense and security strategies tell us that great power competition is on the rise. China is our pacing threat, Russia coming close behind. And I think one exception to that is the Replicator Initiative. I don't know how feasible it is, but trying to get some of these more attritable systems in the acquisition pathways. But then on the other hand, you have, you know, like the U.S. Air Force is mostly divesting of its irregular warfare capabilities. So I think there's multiple questions or potential criticisms here that we could talk about.
And I agree wholeheartedly with all of that. Here's a confounding element to that, which is, you know, psychological and political. So slightly different domain, if you will, which is, you know, the general was talking about IEDs and EFPs. And this is why a larger conversation needs to be had about thresholds. You know, had this decision to, you know, impose a different cost and you know, bare teeth and bare metal earlier in the conflict made itself apparent, which obviously for many political reasons did not or could not, the cost of the Iranian offset or response to that action would have been significantly lower. So in the early 2000s, Iran did not have the ballistic missile arsenal it has today. Iran is walking and chewing gum at the same time on liquid and solid propellant short-range and medium-range missiles. They've moved missiles from a 500, you know, meter circular error probable to a 10 meter circular error probable to a 4 meter circular error. The regime is going to respond. So now the challenge of employing this kinetic solution, which I think rightly is going to have to be needed, and it's not a solution, I misuse that term, the kinetic element in this cocktail of approaches, because it's really going to have to be a cocktail. Different actor, different target, different theater, different series of ingredients. And in some places, the cocktail, the military element or the economic element is going to be more preponderant. Like a martini, it'll be largely gin and vodka with some supporting elements. It is going to be changing based on what, you know, jurisdiction you're going in. Something like Ukraine, you know, you need political, first of all. We need to get our house in order of, do we have the will and the capability to fund some kind of a defense? Then, of course, there's the public diplomacy. Are we going to continue to devote assets to be exposing elements of where Iran is providing this support and have more of those good glossy DIA reports and make sure this is in the bright light so people know the extent of this? From that will be the diplomatic. Can we really get an international coalition to also do the naming and shaming? From that will be the economic. Can we go after the foreign procurement and then the domestic production nodes, as well as these illicit, you know, transportation hubs? And will our partners join us in that? And then on the commercial side, can we do enough not to punish Texas Instruments or, you know, firms in Poland and Ireland and Germany, but to make them more aware? There used to be this thing in the nuclear world, not sanctions lists, but warning lists. We need to go back to creating warning lists for jurisdictions of end user obfuscation or diversion, but also now specifically for such highly available drone technology, and sharing this in the business world. This is a Commerce Department initiative, not a State and Treasury initiative. And we need to do these at the same time. And we need to do these at the same time while making sure we're developing these cheaper offsets so that Shahed 136s face whatever American equivalent of greater capability and cheaper scale at their points of origin, and that we can actually make sure that those who are subject to these kind of capabilities have everything from low-end to high-end air and missile defense, and to begin to sometimes take the fight to the adversary in a deniable way. This is an adversary with high resolve and high interest and limited but evolving capability. It's not going to be solved overnight. The language in D.C., I'm sorry to say, is poor when it comes to restoring deterrence. Like, it's a light switch that we can just, you know, Christmas lights on, Christmas lights off. It doesn't, you guys know better than I, it absolutely doesn't work like that. We didn't lose deterrence overnight. It cannot be rebuilt overnight. But the consistent cocktail approach can help us manage it until we get there.
Okay, because you're talking about Iran being highly resolved, and then both of you are articulating that we need to demonstrate our resolve. And I think you've nailed a few problems with this, because from the academic standpoint, resolve, there's different constituents of it. It's willingness to initiate, which you're now saying is potentially problematic. Historically, our biggest reputation problem was willingness to persist in war. I mean, I'm thinking of like Mogadishu and, you know, Bin Laden's fatwa that articulated that as a moment that sketched our reputation. I'm thinking of al-Zawahiri's comment about our unwillingness to persist in these situations. This goes all the way back to Vietnam and the notion that war could be won just by outlasting us, just like they did the French before us. So, and then the last component is the willingness to impose costs. So all of these aspects of this, I question, especially given our domestic politics, given our war weariness in this region. Currently, given that it's an election year, you know, all of those things play into this. Do we really have the resolve to withstand this at the scale and at the tempo and at the duration that it properly requires? I hope so, but I also question that.
Perhaps war is the wrong word, because I also think philosophically our war binary kind of also puts us in a bind as to will we throw requisite resolve, requisite capability into a conflict when, you know, we have these two rather zero-sum end states of peace or war, and every single adversary we seem to be going up against in the post-war period is operating very much in that in-between. So for someone like me, who is a, you know, proponent of more pressure on the Islamic Republic of Iran, but also fully cognizant of what comes with that pressure, I always say, and then the Iranians will do this, and we have to be prepared for offsetting their counterpunch. But also our method of communication is an issue. So I'd like, also academically, I'm bringing this up, you know, you guys know this better than I, the signaling literature. It says that the signal has to be mutually intelligible. And this is something we get wrong. And, you know, I'm going to do a small Afghanistan pivot, but I think in 2017, we dropped the MOAB, that biggest conventional bomb, the mother of all bombs. And I'm not, you know, a human terrain scholar of Afghanistan in the way that I can tell you stuff about what's going on in Iran, but for an adversary that was running the risks and running the clock and willing to throw people into the meat grinder because they think that we would not run those same risks and run the clock and have the staying power, plus you layer on kind of the Pashtunwali cultural element about the face-to-face combat, the man-to-man combat, us dropping a gigantic bomb, in our view, signaled resolve. Look how far we'll go. But in their view, signaled irresolution, because look how little human resources they may commit to this. And so what ended up trying to be a signal of resolve ends up looking like a signal of irresolution. And that's why we have to understand the intelligibility of these signals.
I mean, you get to the heart of it, right? In the end, this is, you know, in the Clausewitz terms, it's the clash of wills. You have to understand your adversary. how they think, what they value, how far they're willing to go. And you're right, we've done a poor job in really understanding some of our adversaries and what their motivations are, what their willingness to sacrifice is, and really kind of how they'll respond to what we think are signals.
Not just that, but these signals from the, you know, they're talking about the signaling literature. It depends on which audience you're talking about. Because the same signal, like you said, it refracts differently for different audiences. So is it for the domestic audience to signal strength, a retaliatory response? Is it for the adversary? Is it for the principal? Is it for the proxy or the principal? So it's difficult to send a comprehensive signal in one action, which is why this cocktail becomes so important for us to consider. Because I agree, and because we are structuring our force and doing our future force planning with such an exquisite arsenal, we inherently, we're biasing ourselves to signal those types of technocratic or techno-fetishist responses that don't imply our willingness to tolerate human costs. So it's kind of a catch-22 in that sense, too.
Super quick two-finger on this. So you look at it, we have had a poor response ratio across two different administrations against Iran-backed Shia militias in Iraq and Syria. But even in the instances where we do, and more recently, the press release outweighs the kinetic strike in terms of the military utility and the impact of the kinetic strike is drowned out by the press release. Even though the kinetic strike is for the foreign audience and the press release is for the domestic audience, if the foreign audience looks at the press release, they see irresolution when there is a tool designed to signal resolution. And you just saw it now with this recent cyber attack on this, you know, alleged IRGC spy ship near the Red Sea or Gulf of Aden. And there's a trend you could kind of put together in places where the U.S. does not want to use force. Increasingly, there is going to be this cyber component. And for us, that's a source of, you know, national strength, because this is based on an industrial scale capability that we can use to supplement things that go boom. But again, if the adversary has a more static impression of the American use of force and will and capability, then when, you know, it was reported in 2019 that Trump responded to the downing of a drone, not with military, but with cyber, or Trump responded to the attack on Aramco, not with military, but with cyber, or more recently, you know, the Biden administration did not take out a ship enabling the Houthis targeting, but now using cyber, then the adversary may think that they can do something in a manned world and they'll get an unmanned response. And particularly when we talk about resource scarcity, if our most important resource is not our tech, but our humans, as we move people out of the Middle East and into the Asia Pacific, might we actually be inadvertently incentivizing the adversary to mess with those unmanned systems because they can't tell where the threshold for the use of force is, and they think at most they'll get a cyber response. And that's why when you saw, I forgot what task force it was in the Persian Gulf, but we brought the sail drones in. It's a great idea, and I still support it because obviously China is a bigger threat than Iran, and you have to, you know, balance appropriately. But that's why you saw an uptick in the harassment attacks, because they thought that, well, this is an unmanned asset. The threshold to respond is different than with a manned asset.
Very well said.
I guess I'll put it in about one sentence. I, on the whole cyber versus, you know, kind of a more kinetic approach, you know, with the idea of that ship, right? So you got this Iranian ship that's reportedly selecting targets for the Houthis. And I agree. I think a cyber attack looks to our adversary not like a demonstration of strength, but a demonstration of weakness. I don't have to bear the consequences of this statement, but if it were me, I'd put a bomb on it and it'd be under the water right now.
Thank you for listening to the Social Science of War podcast. This podcast was brought to you by the Department of Social Sciences at West Point. If you enjoyed the episode, please consider subscribing, leave a rating and comment, and most importantly, please share the Social Science of War with others. One final note, what you heard in this episode does not represent the views of West Point or any other agency of the U.S. government.